questions? So everyone's up to date with their homework, so that's why there are no questions, I'm sure. So, chapter 2, we go through a bunch of examples with the idea of illuminating the general case, which is chapter 3. Chapter 4 is a kind of fakey sort of potential, but it's got some good features. So it's an attractive delta function. So attractive means the potential energy is negative. That's why we've got a minus sign. And we've got our delta function, which is highly singular, zero every place except where its argument is zero. And it's so singular at zero that the area under the curve is one. And we've run into them before in electricity and magnetism, where we use them to represent point charges. But those are actually three-dimensional delta functions. But it's not all that different. I think it's helpful to remember this kind of stack of functions so we know how we can get derivatives of things. And we could go even one step further and look at derivatives of delta functions. So a delta function is highly peaked. If we integrate it, we get zero until we go through the delta function, then we get one. And notice that if we take the derivative of the theta function, we get the delta function, right? Zero derivative here, zero derivative there, infinite derivative where the step is. And if we integrate these more and more and more, we get all of these possibilities. These guys are fake names for nu and eta. Theta function is a well-defined thing. And kind of the upshot of this is in Schrodinger's equation, which I guess I didn't write down, there's no delta function. There's nothing singular about the right-hand side, energy times psi. I guess I can write it down. There's nothing singular on this side, so the delta function that is sitting there has to somehow be canceled. It has to be canceled by taking a couple of derivatives. So it must be that psi looks kind of like this. It must have a discontinuity in slope, so when you take two derivatives of it, you generate a delta function to calculate to get rid of that delta function. And we went through that, and we found out that psi looked kind of like that, exponentially decreasing as we move away from the origin, and therefore with a discontinuity in the slope at x equals zero. And the discontinuity of the slope we deal with by integrating the Schrodinger equation. And it works out pretty reasonable. We get one bound state. It's normalizable. Of course, has negative energy because it's in the potential, as it were. One thing that is worth cogitating on, I don't think I stressed this last time, is what the units of alpha are, right? So we stress units in the first year of physics, but then, they kind of start to disappear when we get lots of complications. So one thing that is very odd about the delta function is it has units, right? Every other function you've ever run to doesn't produce any units. But the units of delta are the 1 over the units of whatever is between the parentheses. So the units of this delta by itself have to be 1 over length. And so alpha has to have the units of energy times length if it's going to be, in fact, a length. So we can check out our units on all of these equations if we're a little bit careful. And of course, going to dimensionless units kind of does that all automatically to us. So what's somewhat new and different. We've had bound states before. We also look at positive energy solutions, so-called free solutions. And we could do this a variety of different ways, and the book does it a variety of different ways. I looked at this particular case where I have an incoming wave that's going that away. I have a reflective wave that's going that away. And beyond the delta function, I have some wave that's transmitted. And we argued that even though this wave function isn't normalizable, we can interpret it as being a flux of electrons, a flux that had, and we calculate what the current is, and we get that amount. So the reflected probability is the incoming flux dividing into the reflected flux. And we went through and calculated what B over A was, and roughly speaking, what this meant was the reflection coefficient was 1 for low energy incoming particles, and it went to 0 for high energy incoming particles. And this quantity beta, roughly speaking, was the incoming wavelength, which would of course be small at high energy, divided by the size of this bound state wave function. Questions on that? And then we started to get the setup for example 5, which was a finite square wave problem. So here's the setup. We've got a zero potential every place except inside this box where the potential is minus V naught. And we're looking at bound state solutions, so the energy is going to be negative. This is what Schrodinger's equation looks like. And remembering that V is minus V naught, it actually looks like that. And you should remember that that energy is negative. Kinetic energy is, of course, the difference between the potential energy and the actual energy. So here, the kinetic energy has to be negative, whatever that means. And the plan is to seek kind of even and odd solutions to this differential equation. Questions? So one thing to be a little bit careful of is the book kind of shifts the definition of A. When we had an infinite square well potential, then the full width of that potential was from 0 to A. Now we have a finite depth, and the full width of that potential is from minus A to A, it's 2A. Right, so I've been pretty careful to call the full width of these square wells from 0 to L, and A is then going to be half of L. But if you kind of randomly select your equations from the book, you can run into trouble. Well, there's kind of a lot of algebra, and it's very easy to get overwhelmed by the algebra, so might be worthwhile taking a look at what these solutions look like but before we get very far. So again, we want to present lots of wave functions, so we use the stacked wave function approach where the zero for the wave function is pushed up according to the energy that it has. And I don't know, so in dimensionless units, these are some examples of some wave functions. And you might notice that, I don't know, if you kind of squint your eyes, these things kind of look like the wave functions for the infinite bound well, except for the infinite square well, the wave function actually had to be zero here. And it's not zero, it's nearly zero, but the extent to which it's nearly zero fails as we go to closer and closer to the free case. So the penetration we get into the classically disallowed region kind of depends on how disallowed it is. If we have a huge amount of negative kinetic energy, then we get a fairly fast exponential decay. If we have only a moderate amount of negative kinetic energy, then we can get more and more penetration. So we actually go from having nodes, close to nodes at the edges of the state, to having close to antinodes at the state.
Mm-hmm. So is this negative kinetic energy, is that just like relative to the well's energy, or?
Yeah, so you're saying negative kinetic energy makes no sense because 1/2 mv squared is a positive definite quantity. Yep, so.
Relative to the well, then?
No, it's not relative to the well, it's negative kinetic energy. Somehow or other that quantity can be negative even though it doesn't seem to be possible. So we can find the particle here. And the energy of that particle is less than the potential energy at that location. Okay, not classically possible, but possible in quantum mechanics. If we make this well not quite so deep, so here's of course the game. What we're going to do is we're going to be matching the exponentially decaying function to the oscillating function at that point. So I don't know, there's an example of what this match looks like. You might notice that the curvature on this side is positive, whereas the curvature on that side is negative. That is to say, there's a discontinuity in the second derivative of this wave function at this point. But the first derivative and the value of the function are continuous at that spot. Okay, so here we've made the well not quite so deep, and you might notice that now there's even more penetration as this wave function starts to get almost classically allowed. And if we lower this a little bit more, we lose that bound state. So the number of bound states depends on how deep the potential is. If it were infinite, then we'd have an infinite number of states, just like the infinite square well. But and if it only goes up so high, then we're going to lose a corresponding number of states. Questions? Okay, so that's what we're shooting for. This is going to take, wow, it's going to take a fair amount of work to get there. And you've got this kind of cheat sheet in order to kind of follow along with the kind of ugly algebra that it's going to take. Okay, so we've got kind of three regions that we can concern ourselves about. We've got this region here, which is classically disallowed, because the potential is more than the energy. Here we have normal amounts of kinetic energy, call that region 2, and here we have another classically disallowed region 3. And the only difference between these various regions is whether this constant is positive or negative, right? So in this region, E minus V is going to be some positive number, and so this constant is going to be some negative number. So in region 2, let me call this constant minus k squared. In regions 1 and 3, then the energy is less than the potential. So this quantity is going to, the kinetic energy, as it were, is going to be negative. So this whole quantity is going to be positive. So let me call this plus kappa squared. And kappas look a whole lot like k's. Sorry about that. Okay, so either one of these differential equations are pretty easy to solve, right? So here we have psi double prime is minus a constant times psi. So we know that the solutions are things like sine and cosine of kx. And here the second derivative is equal to plus k squared. So here we know we have solutions that are like e to the minus kx and e to the plus kx. And obviously, to make this thing normalizable, we're going to use e to the minus kx in region 3, and we're going to use e to the plus kx in region 1. And whether we use sines or cosines depends upon whether we're looking for an even or odd solution. And we're just going to have to do those cases separately. That was one of the reasons the infinite square well was easy, is there weren't two cases. So if we start with some sort of sine function, we might get a wave function, for example, that looks kind of like that. And we're interested in finding exactly what energy is going to work. And as stated, at this location, at x equals a and minus a, we're going to want to set continuous values for the function and continuous values for the derivative. Notice, because if we set it up, because of the evenness or oddness, if we set things up so that they work on the right, they're guaranteed to work on the left. So we really only need to focus on x equals a, and x equals minus a will come along for the ride. Okay, so off to the races. So let's take a look at the odd solutions, or let's take a look at the even solutions. So there in region 2, we're going to have a wave function that goes like a cosine of kx. And in region 3, we're going to have a wave function that looks like b e to the minus kappa x. And of course, the derivative of this is easy to calculate. We're going to get minus ak sine kx. And here we're going to get psi prime is minus kappa b e to the minus kx. And what we require is that psi wants to be continuous at x equals plus a, and psi prime wants to be continuous at x equals a. And we save ourselves a lot of time. I mean, you could write two equations and two unknowns. We save ourselves a lot of time by looking at psi over psi prime, because then this unknown constant is going to automatically cancel out, which it would when we looked at these things separately. Okay, so it's just a little bit of a shortcut. We really do want to have psi continuous and psi prime continuous, but the action is all going to happen by looking at psi prime over psi. And it's helpful to have a name for this quantity. This quantity I'm going to call the log derivative, because it is the derivative of the natural log of psi. That's a statement of no consequence. We just need a name for something so we can talk about it quickly. Okay, so what do we got? We've got psi prime over psi inside the box. So that's going to be minus k sine ka, that's where we're trying to match things up, divided by cosine of ka. And that wants to be equal, the b's cancel, we're going to get a minus kappa, and then the e to the minus ka's are going to cancel. Okay, so kappa is of course a terrible thing to be writing when we've got k's. So let's as quickly as possible get rid of that k. So what we've got is that k squared is equal to 2m over h bar squared e minus v, and the potential is minus v naught, so we've got that. And if we just kind of spread this out, we've got 2m v naught over h bar squared plus 2m e over h bar squared. And remember that this energy is negative, so this is 2m v naught over h bar squared minus kappa squared. Now you notice that what's occurring all the time is k times a. So really, what I'm going to care about is that quantity. So let me multiply through this equation by a squared. So I've got k squared a squared is equal to v naught divided by h bar squared over 2m a squared plus, oops, minus kappa squared a squared. And I've written this in this kind of funny form because this is going to be our unit of energy. So I can call this whole quantity energy over our unit of energy. I'm going to call this v naught prime, the dimensionless version of the potential energy depth. So this is something that the book doesn't do. We both have our reasons for doing it. I like to know what the potential is. So I like to label that constant quantity with something that reminds me that what I've got there is potential energy. Okay, so if we kind of switch these things around then, what we've got is that Ka is the square root of V naught prime minus Ka squared. So now we only have Ka's, and I'll follow the book in calling K times Az. So what I've got then is, and let me bring the z to the other side of the equation, what I've got is then that tangent of z wants to equal the square root of v naught prime divided by z squared minus 1. Okay, so let me just mention what the book does, which certainly makes lots of sense. They call this what I call the dimensionless version of the potential, they call Z naught squared. But as I say, I like to choose letters that remind me of what the quantity actually is. Okay, so if you pick a random value of Z, it doesn't work, right? So we need to solve this equation. And try as you might, you're not going to find an algebraic solution to it. There's no formula for the resulting Z. So, and of course, Mathematica can happily find these solutions for us with like the find root functionality. So we're going to choose to have a graphical method in order to find graphically these solutions. And if you actually have to find these solutions numerically, as I say, Mathematica, or typically your calculators also have a find root functionality. So the plan is to graph the right-hand side and graph the left-hand side, and then look at where we get intersections. All right, so here's Z. What does the tangent function look like? Well, the tangent function is singular at 90 degrees and whatever that is, 270 degrees, etc. Odd multiples of pi over 2. And the tangent function, of course, starts at 0. It looks kind of like this. What does the right-hand side of that look like? Well, for small z, that's going to go to infinity. But as z gets bigger and bigger and bigger, we're going to be subtracting something that's very close to the value. Eventually, at what the book called z naught, we're going to have a zero inside the radical. So that function is going to look like zero at what the book calls z naught, which I would call the square root of v naught, the square root of the dimensionless version of the potential energy, and it looks kind of like that. So these points where we're going to have solutions are going to be points where we have intersections. And I hope you can see that if we are looking at the very deep states, and particularly cases where z naught is way off to the side, these solutions are going to be approximately at an odd number of pi over 2, right? They're going to happen pretty much at these asymptotes. On the other hand, when we get close to the last data point for this highest energy solution, this is going to occur where z is about equal to an even number times pi over 2. One less than the corresponding odd number. And if we go through that process and we plug in what this z tells us about the energy, and we might as well go through and see how that's going to work. So it's probably less confusing to think about what the energy is above the bottom than to think about what the actual energy is. So if we look at what the energy is above the bottom, remember that this thing is all equal to k squared. So E minus V is equal to h bar squared k squared divided by 2m. And what we have isn't k, it's z. So this is going to be h bar squared over 2m a squared. That's our unit of energy times those corresponding values of z squared. And if you want the actual value of the energy, then of course you're going to have the same quantity plus v, and what plus v is minus v naught, right? And you're going to get a negative value then for these energies. Okay. So in order to have Mathematica find these things, you're going to have to use something like the find root function, and you would put this equation in here, right? I'm not going to do it all. But in order for Mathematica to find a solution to this equation, you have to give it an initial guess. And the way to give it an initial guess is to actually look at this graph and just read it and give it an initial guess. Okay, Mathematica slash nobody can tell you what those roots are algebraically. So we need to do this so-called numerically. Okay, good. So those are the even solutions. How about the odd solutions? So for the odd solutions, I'm going to have psi be a sine of kx, which of course means that psi prime is going to be a k cosine of kx. And I'm going to have the same thing in region 3, namely psi is equal to b times e to the minus kappa x, and psi prime is going to be minus kappa b e to the minus kappa x. And again, if I look at psi prime over psi, the so-called logarithmic derivative, I get rid of those unknowns a and b immediately. And what I've got then is k times cosine over sine is the cotangent, is equal to minus k. And we can see what k is. Well, let's multiply everything by a like we did before. And what we've got here then is the square root of the dimensionless version of the potential divided by z squared minus 1. Okay, well, what does the cotangent function look like? Well, cotangent function is just 1 over the tangent function, so it's going to have problems any place that a tangent is equal to 0. And tangent is equal to 0 at 0 and pi and 2 pi, 3 pi. So the cotangent function looks kind of like this. And this function we're matching with looks something like that, right? It's negative. So we're going to get intersections now at points like this, where if the potential is deep, are going to approximately equal an even number times pi over 2, right? To just give us integer multiples of pi. Okay, and once we get those values of z, we're all set to calculate the corresponding energies. Okay. So a lot of the fun comes in bringing back all of the dimensionless quantities. So this sort of potential is actually not a bad potential for the nuclear potential. And so one of the problems I have is give you numbers for what V naught is, something like 50 MeV, and the size of a nucleus, a few Fermis, 10 to the minus 15th meters, and a proton, and figure out where these energy levels are for a proton that's bouncing around inside of a nucleus. Okay, questions? So a funny way of solving finding these solutions, because there isn't an algebraic answer. In the limit of very deep potentials, it's got to reproduce infinite square well, but as we reach the top, it's going to basically slip instead of having the integer n, that's going to have the integer n minus 1 for that top level state. Oh, there's one other important feature, and that is no matter how weak I make this potential, there's always one bound state. Right? So you can see how I can lose a state if I just make this potential less strong. Now I've only got these two solutions. But no matter how weak I make that potential, there's always one bound state. And that's not going to be the case for the even states, right? So for small potential, there's going to be no even intersections. So we lose states one by one, but we can never lose the bottommost state, which is an even state. And that result, I don't know, should sound, I don't know if it sounds a little bit funny to you or not. It's a product of us being in one dimension. If we were to work the same problem in two dimensions, for very small potentials, there would be no bound states. Okay, so those are the bound states. How about the scattering states? How do we work those problems? Well, it's actually, I think I might as well erase lots of this. Okay, so with scattering states, we still have the same well, and the states I'm shooting for, and I could shoot for other states, are going to be the same ones we've talked about before, where I have an incoming wave that is e to the I kx, and I have a reflective wave, which is r e to the minus I kx, and we have some transmitted wave that is e to the I kx, and we have to have something that's going on inside of the box also. And because this doesn't have symmetry, it's easier to work the problem if we don't bother with the symmetric choice of our origin of x, and instead we switch over to the unsymmetrical origin that goes from 0 to L. Okay, so what is the solution? So what we've got, if the energy is positive, now we always have kinetic energy. So if we have an energy that is, say, that amount, we have a relatively slow-moving particle here, but we've got a fast-moving particle here. Everything's classically allowed, which is why we have these infinitely extensive states. Let's call this quantity, when we're outside the box, let's call it minus k squared. Minus again because because the energy is positive and V naught is positive, right? Because the potential was minus V naught. When we're inside the box, let me call it minus q squared. So, I mean, we know how to solve that equation. We're going to get sines or cosines or exponentials. It's going to be moderately convenient to use sines and cosines in here, even though we could use exponentials. So I'm going to write the solution here as a cosine qx plus b sine qx. And now I don't have symmetry going for me, so I'm going to have to match the wave function and its derivative at x equals 0, and I'm going to have to match the wave function and its derivative at x equals L. Okay, so I still have, so now I really have kind of three regions that I care about. That I can't say that region 1 is just the reflection of region 3. I actually have to deal with all of this stuff. Okay, so let's take a look at x equals 0. So the value of the wave function, and again here the wave function is going to be e to the I kx plus r e to the minus I kx. Incidentally, in the past, we put an a here and a b here, but we might as well just have an incoming flux of one, right? It saves a noticeable amount of algebra to do that. And here we have a wave function that is t e to the ikx. Okay, so at x equals 0, what we have, plug in x equals 0 for the value of the wave function, what we have is 1 plus r, that's what I get here. And if I plug in x is 0 here, of course sine is 0, cosine is 1, and I get a. For the derivative, what's going to happen is I'm going to bring down k's with a minus sign there. So I'm going to get I k 1 minus r. And if I take the derivative of this, the cosine is going to become a sine. So when I plug in x equals 0, it's going to disappear. The sine is going to become a cosine. So when I plug in x equals 1, I'm going to get 1. And I'm going to get q times b. So, I don't know, what I'm going to do is to get these things have the same units, to divide through by the ik. And then just add those two equations, because then I get rid of an unknown. So I've got then that 2 is equal to a plus q over ikb. Okay, so I started with two equations and I've gotten rid of an unknown r and I've cranked it down to one equation and two unknowns, which isn't good enough. So at x equals l, what I've got for my wave function is 1 plus r, better write it right. No, sorry. So inside what I've got is a cosine of QL plus B sine of QL, and that all wants to equal T times E to the minus I, plus I KL. If I look at the derivative of the wave function, so what I'm going to get here, derivative of cosine is minus sine, everything's going to have a Q. So I'm going to get a times sine of QL plus b times cosine of QL. And that's all going to equal IKT e to the IKL. So if I do kind of the same trick, if I divide this through by ik, this is q over ik is equal to minus a sine of ql plus b times cosine of ql, and that's all equal to t e to the ikl. And I can get rid of a t by just setting those two things equal. And then I have one equation, looks pretty ugly, one equation with two unknowns, A and B. Okay, it looks kind of ugly at this point. Two equations and two unknowns, it's solvable. Hold off on that for a second. So what I can find then is what, I can find a formula for A. And once I've got my formula for A, I can plug it into this equation and say that R is equal to A minus 1, and then I have my reflection coefficient. Okay, so that's the second page that you've got. So if you look on this side of it, we've got Mathematica code. So I have exactly the equations that I need to solve, two equations and two unknowns, and I want to solve it for A and B. And you can see in line 7 that the equation you finally get for the reflection coefficient isn't hugely ugly. Moderately ugly. The one important thing to recognize, if you look at the version that's on line 15, is in the numerator we've got a... So I've gone to dimensionless coordinates at this point, so Q1 is equal to what I called Q times L. So what we've got is that R is going to be equal to 0 if Q times L equals an integer multiple of pi. So remember that Q is basically 2 pi over the wavelength. So if we have an integer number of half wavelengths inside this box, that's when the reflection coefficient is going to go to 0. But otherwise, you know, this formula is not particularly beautiful. So here are some graphs of what the reflection coefficient is. So this is what it is if I take the dimensionless potential to be 100 and 50 and 25 and 12.5. So they all have the same characteristic, namely that for low energy, for small, and this is plotted as a function of k, the incoming momentum. So you can all see that for small values of k, which is to say small values of energy, we get 100% reflection, just as we did with the delta function potential. For high energies, we get relatively small values of reflection, and we get these little waves. And in particular, we have 0 when Q times L is equal to a multiple of pi. Okay, so I don't know, not too impressive, but actually this was early evidence for quantum mechanics. So people could actually do this experiment in 3 dimensions, not in 2 dimensions, not in 1 dimension, and seeing these sorts of oscillations in reflection coefficients from atoms was a hint that people were on the right track in terms of the corresponding quantum mechanics. Questions? So again, it might be worth reminding you, of course, classically there's no reflection, right? This particle zooms along here at slow speed. When it goes to this little potential, it speeds up, and it goes there. There are no turning points. So the only reason this particle is bouncing back is because of its wave nature and seeing this sharp change in potential. That's what causes the reflection. Questions? Okay, so we've now seen a whole slew of examples, and we have the example that is too much algebra currently to work, but which you remember, and that's the hydrogen atom, where we have bound states that are at this magic number minus 13.6 eV divided by n. And there are, of course, continuous states. Usually these aren't stressed so much, but there are electrons can happily fly by a proton at high speed with some probability of reflection. So bound states that are normalizable and have discrete energy values, and then a continuum of positive energy solutions where we could have scattering. That's kind of the normal situation. So what's next? So what's next is to look at the general case and along the way to look at the appendix that's on linear algebra. And in linear algebra, my guess is that you mostly dealt with finite dimensional vector spaces. And the idea is that we can hopefully boost a lot of that work with finite dimensional vector spaces into the infinite dimensional vector space that that is function spaces. So we talked about this in E&M. If we think about a vector as a function of a index, we can generalize that to thinking about a function where the index is a real number. Right, so if I want to find v2, the y component of the vector, I plug in 2 and I get a number. Now with our infinite dimensional vector spaces, the number of dimensions is indexed by a real number, x. And so if I plug in x, I get the value of the component in that direction. We've looked at operators that operate on our functions to give us new functions. And we had matrices which operated on finite vectors to give us vectors. And I'm not never sure how far you get in linear algebra, but I hoped you looked at eigenequations like this, where the matrix operating on a vector just gave us a constant times that vector. And that's, of course, the equivalent to what we've got with our time-independent Schrodinger equation. When h operates on psi, we just get a multiple of psi back. So a lot of this is the same. We've got the difference between infinite dimensions and finite dimensions, which turns out not to be that important. There's one big difference. There are two big differences that we've got over just traditional vector spaces. One is that here, this vector was complex. And my guess is that you just dealt with real valued vector spaces. True, false? But you can have n tuples that are complex numbers just as well as you can have any other sorts of things. Now the other thing we've got going for us in quantum mechanics is we have a dot product, right? So we have this ability to take two vectors and add up all of the possibilities where x goes from some range, right? So that's the equivalent of taking two vectors and adding up their finite number of components. So in 191, we called this thing a dot product. And I guess we're mostly thinking about them being three-dimensional vectors, but it's obvious how to expand that out to be an n-dimensional vector. We have to be a little bit careful now that we have complex numbers. Because one very important property we had for the dot product was that v dot v was greater than or equal to 0. And in fact, v dot v equals 0 if and only if v was the 0 vector. So in the complex world, if we don't do anything different, we're going to have problems, right? Because if I have a vector that is, for example, I 0, 0, and I dot it with itself with the traditional method, I'm going to get a norm that is minus 1. But it doesn't take a lot of work in order to fix up that property. All I need to do is to take the complex conjugate of that guy And that, now if I take the dot product of these two guys, so I have minus I, 0, 0, dotted into I, 0, 0, I'm going to get plus 1. So we've got a new formula for a dot product, and of course we did exactly the same thing in our version of quantum mechanics. So we've expanded out the idea of a dot product, and we have these important properties of that dot product. And of course we name things for famous dead physicists downstairs. So we have to name these things for famous dead mathematicians. So things like this, where we have a dot product, complex vectors go under the name of Hilbert spaces. Fire drill. So I think we're not coming back, right, with what, 5 minutes left in class?